from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Around the country, cash-strapped states are rushing to gambling to balance state budgets. Maryland and the District of Columbia are reaching for gambling revenue. Ohio and Delaware are looking to jump in. Pennsylvania just okayed 61,000 slot machines, which may set off a fresh scramble in the Northeast, with other states upping the ante by authorizing more gaming outlets themselves. California is moving to pump up gambling in the state's take of the take. Since 1988, when the federal government authorized states and Indian tribes to negotiate gambling deals, more than 350 tribal casinos have shot up across the country. Interstate competition for gaming revenues is stiff and the stakes are high. For state coffers, for the Indian tribes managing casinos, for communities, and for the poor and the addicted. But does it really ultimately pay for state treasuries? Tonight on Point, the gambling fix. Is your state floating on gambling revenue? Do you wish it would? Is this the magic answer to state budget dreams and woes? What is the bottom line on gambling? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Christopher Palmieri, senior correspondent for Businessweek. He covers the gaming industry. Good evening, Christopher Palmieri. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
What's going on? Why all the fresh interest from state governments in gambling, Christopher?
Well, it has to do a lot with budget deficits, and it took a little while to happen. People, as this sort of recession started a couple of years ago, people thought it was actually going to happen a lot faster, but it's sort of taken a little way to work its way through the system, but now we're seeing that. And so it also happens around the end of the fiscal year for the states, which just for most of them just ended in July. So that's where you're seeing this big push, for example, Pennsylvania.
But a bunch of states, not all by any means, but some have seen their state revenues rebound as the economy has come back a little bit, and yet they're still reaching for gambling revenues. Has this just become the kind of irresistible opportunity out there? Politicians just can't resist the idea of another billion, two, three in their coffers?
Well, I think a lot of the stigma of gambling has fallen because it is already so ubiquitous. A lot of people live in big cities, and there tend not to be the casinos in the downtown, so people don't think of them there. But the fact of the matter is, I think most Americans at this point live within 2 hours of a casino, whether it's a Indian one or one in a neighboring state. And so I think people have just sort of become to accept it, and politicians realize that, and it's a quick revenue source for them.
Looking at this as an industry, how much elasticity is there here? How much demand? Can you endlessly put up casinos around the country, around states, and count on them to draw in enough traffic to continue to be cash cows?
It seems like that the competition would eventually eat into themselves, but the pie just keeps growing and growing. It is really amazing, and people are just spending a lot more time and a lot more money in casinos.
And that seems like it can go on and on. A bunch of states have done this already, a dozen or so. Has it paid for the ones who have already taken the dive?
Well, yes, about a dozen, as you mentioned, states have commercial casinos, not Indian ones, and they generate about $27 billion in revenues and about $4.3 billion a year in taxes for those 12 states. So that's a huge amount of money.
How do Las Vegas and Atlantic City look at all this? Is there enough trade for them? Can they continue to grow if there's gambling close to home? Nobody has to travel anymore.
And that gets into your earlier question about demand just seeming to expand. Las Vegas first and Atlantic City now are sort of reinventing themselves, and you're seeing just bigger and more elaborate casinos, and that keeps people coming. Las Vegas is just booming right now, and Atlantic City had a huge new casino, the Borgata, opened last summer, and now all the other casino operators in Atlantic City are scrambling to build bigger and better attractions. So they're learning to compete, some markets, Laughlin, Nevada, and Reno, for example, are hurting because of all the Indian casinos in California, but the more established markets just sort of learn to compete.
Now, what about California's recent move? What is it that Arnold Schwarzenegger wants to do?
Well, when Indian gaming has sort of snuck up in a way, I mean, it's been going on for 20 years, but in California, it was really just 5 years ago that the governor signed compacts, and he didn't, as some states, most notably Connecticut, get a large share of the revenue. And so all of a sudden, we have a $5 billion gambling business here in California, of which the state gets practically nothing. And so the governor last month signed a deal with four of the larger tribes where they would finance $1 billion cash infusion into the state and contribute ongoing percentages of their new slot machines. And Governor Schwarzenegger is hoping to cut similar deals with other tribes.
And what kind of percentage of their gambling revenues would the state of California get?
It's about 16%, but this is on new business because he can't renegotiate the old deal.
Right.
So, it could potentially be hundreds of millions of dollars, but at this point, it's not that.
And what about the Pennsylvania move, Christopher? When a state like Pennsylvania, with so many large populations in other states not far away, announces it's going to put in 61,000 slot machines, does that have some kind of knock-on effect that would encourage neighboring states or even more distant states to do the same? Does it rob from nearby states and increase pressure for them to jump in the game?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question. And so Maryland, the District of Columbia, you'll see that. Atlantic City obviously is not happy about this, but some of the Atlantic City operators will operate the properties in Pennsylvania. And Atlantic City will have to just create more attractions that keep people coming to New Jersey.
Christopher, finally, when the analysts who look at the so-called gaming industry now think about its ultimate potential, is there, what do they see? Where does it stand now in terms of total revenues, and where might it go?
Well, I've seen some numbers suggesting, that Americans spend $500 billion on gambling of some sorts, including lottery and racetracks and all the casinos, which is just a staggering amount of money. A quarter of all Americans, or some 50 million people, go to casinos regularly. It's just growing, and it will continue to.
No end in sight, and a lot of states looking at that golden goose, but we're looking at just how golden it is. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Christopher Palmieri is a senior correspondent for Business Week. He covers the gambling industry. He spoke with us from Los Angeles. Joining me now in the studio is Richard McGowan, professor of economics at Boston College and author of several books on gaming. His forthcoming book is Dividing the Spoils, States and the Gambling Industry. Richard McGowan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Also joining us from Chaesu, Korea, is Bill Thompson, professor of public administration at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. He's author of Gambling in America. He recently compiled a report for the state of Pennsylvania, estimating state revenues that new slot machines would generate, and a report for Pennsylvania Citizens Group, analyzing the wider economic impact of the slots. Good evening and welcome from far-flung Korea, Bill Thompson.
Well, I'm happy to be here, happy to make the connection.
Thanks so much for getting up so early in the morning on the other side of the planet.
Well, it is 8 in the morning out here, so
not too bad. Bill, you did the math for Pennsylvania.
Sure.
That got everybody excited there. Governor Ed Rendell dove in. We'll hear from his chief of staff later in
sure.
the hour. But walk us through the kind of numbers you gave Pennsylvania that left them sort of drooling for gambling.
Well, I'll give the approximates. A slot machine in an urban area will make in excess of $100,000 a year. That's one machine will take that much money away from the players. That's after they give all the jackpots.
Right, got it.
The net revenue, $100,000 a machine. If they have 61,000 machines, that projects to over $6 billion in revenue, meaning money players lose. And the state wants to have a 34% tax, so that gives you about $2 billion. Now, in my study, I talked about 30,000 machines producing $3 billion with $1 billion in state revenue. I think the governor loved my report so much that he doubled the number of machines in his proposal.
So that's the cash-in side
that's
for
in,
the state.
And I think it's extremely important that two questions be asked and answered.
Yeah.
And in my report for the Citizens Group, I used the 100,000 and I asked these questions. Where does the money come from and where does the money go? And the answer is the money comes out of people's pockets. I point out that Las Vegas, we're in a desert and we don't have any trees, but we got a ton of money. You're in Pennsylvania, you're broke, but you've got all these beautiful trees. The money doesn't grow on trees. It comes out of people's pockets. Whose pockets? If you go into an urban center, it comes out of the people that live in that city, in that metropolitan area. 100% of the money that's going to go into the machines in Philadelphia will be money that is already in Philadelphia.
Well, someone's going to come from out of town to a convention there and hit a slot machine.
They're going to come to a convention and play a slot machine instead of going to a restaurant, instead of going to a show,
okay.
instead of going to a ball game.
Right.
It's money they would otherwise bring into Philadelphia. There will be no new infusion of money into Philadelphia because of the machine. Now, the second question is equally important. Where does the money go to? So you have that $100,000 machine. Where does it go? Well, the state's going to take 34%. Well, they're not going to return that money to Philadelphia. It goes to Harrisburg. They're going to send it statewide. So Philadelphia's stuck with a loss of about half that money. So
okay.
Philadelphia loses about 20% on that deal. Then they have to buy machines, and the machine costs $15,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
The machines are made in Reno, Nevada by the IGT company, and we also make some Bally's in Las Vegas. That's another loss of about 5% of the revenue. Then there are other expenses. Most of that will stay. The employees, of course, will live in Philadelphia. But then you come down to the bottom line profits, and I figured the machines are going to make about 30% for the owners, but the owners are out-of-state firms. They will take over half the profits out of the state. And I just figured through a little analysis, and about half of the money will leave the state, or will leave the Philadelphia region.
So in other words, a single slot machine nets out at $100,000,
right.
and $50,000 of that goes out of Philadelphia.
Goes out of Philadelphia. And guess what $50,000 represents? For, say, $18 an hour, it represents one job. Each slot machine in Philadelphia will represent a loss of one job for Philadelphia. Now, that's not a way to build an economy, and although the state will pick up tax money, if they are exporting jobs and losing jobs, pretty soon that tax money won't be there. And you can look at all the states that have already introduced gambling and ask if any of those states have budget problems. The answer is yes, just about all of them.
Of course they do. Bill Thompson, stand by. Richard McGowan, join in here. On the one hand, it looks absolutely dazzlingly appetizing to state governments when people like yourself and Bill Thompson can put up those big numbers and say you're going to make $1 billion or $2 billion or $3 billion a year. On the other hand, Bill has done the math and says you're going to end up, as individual communities, losing a lot of money, and the state governments rush in anyway. Why?
Well, one of the things I think of Bill's, it's a little more complicated than that in Pennsylvania. First of all, you had the state of Delaware really started the war in that region.
Because they've already got their gambling going on.
In fact, 9% of the revenue, right now, 9% of Delaware's total revenue comes from gambling.
9% of the state's revenue.
9% of Delaware's revenue comes from gambling.
Little innocent Delaware.
Little innocent Delaware has started a war.
So Pennsylvania feels if we don't get in the game, we're losers.
Think about where Pennsylvania is coming from. You have New Jersey with casino gambling.
Right.
In Atlantic City. You already have Delaware with lots of slot machines in their racetracks. And then you have West Virginia on the other side of Pennsylvania has slot machines. And New York has opened up a series of Native American casinos all up through upper New York.
So they feel surrounded by the dens of iniquity.
And of course now Maryland is saying, well, if Pennsylvania goes, we'll go. I think so really, to me, the argument that's probably the biggest one, the state legislator, is that if they're already paying some of the social costs, for instance, the addiction cost.
Right.
And the other states are making this revenue from Pennsylvania. So, for instance, well over 40% of the cars in Delaware are from Pennsylvania.
So the
argument comes down to then from the legislator point of view is, for God's sakes, we're already paying some of the social costs already, so let's try to cash in. Now, that doesn't justify, and I could see some of Bill's figures, but you could see where a legislator says, okay, let's reclaim some of the revenue.
We've got a lot to dig into here, and it's a dynamic that's hitting a lot of states across the country. We're talking tonight about the gaming fix, cash-strapped states across the country turning to big-time gambling to balance their budgets. You can join our conversation tonight. Is your state floating on gambling revenues? Do you wish it would? Is this the magic answer to state budget woes? Are we headed for coast-to-coast gambling in every city, village, and town? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the gambling fix, about states across the country turning to gambling to balance budgets. You can join the conversation tonight. Why is gambling such an appealing golden goose to state leaders? Does gambling ultimately pay? And have slots and casinos been a boon or a bust for your community? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking tonight with Bill Thompson, professor of public administration at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas and author of Gambling in America. With me in the studio, Richard McGowan, economics professor at Boston College, author of the forthcoming Dividing the Spoils. And now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, John Estey. He's chief of staff for Pennsylvania Governor Edward Rendell. Good evening and welcome, John Estey.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you. Walk us through this. We're hearing the pressure that's on states like Pennsylvania to get in the game when you're surrounded by other states that are. On the other hand, is this really going to pay in the end, or are you grabbing on to a kind of will-o'-the-wisp, a kind of quick fix that, that bottom line isn't really there?
I think there are a couple of points that your guests have already made that are worth reemphasizing, and a couple new points that I'd like to throw into the mix here. First of all, Pennsylvania is not the keystone state for nothing. I mean, we're surrounded by six other states, three of which, as your guests have already noted, have slots at, in various forms, Delaware, New Jersey, and West Virginia. And, of course, New York is now making an aggressive move with their Native American casinos. So we export about $3 billion a year of Pennsylvanians' money to those various and sundry gaming jurisdictions. So we start with that basic premise that Pennsylvania dollars are leaving this state and going to support programs in other states. They've been doing that in New Jersey since 1976.
And have you calculated, by putting in 61,000 slots, how much of that you're going to staunch?
We have not engaged in that, and I have to make a point about the 61,000. 61,000 is the maximum number of machines that are authorized by the legislation that passed here 2 weeks ago. The legislation itself only authorizes approximately 38,000 machines initially. The commission that will be set up by this piece of legislation can authorize additional machines up to 61,000, but we're not talking about 61,000 machines on day one. Important to note that.
But a lot of machines and the potential for a lot more.
A lot of machines and the potential for a lot more. But there's another important point that I think I have to make other than the exporting issue here, and that is that Pennsylvania never, the Governor Rendell nor the legislature, ever intended that any of the dollars generated by these machines would go to support the general fund operations of the Commonwealth. And in that regard, we are different in many respects from other states that have legalized gaming. Every dollar that's generated by slot machines at these new venues in Pennsylvania goes to property tax relief or to supporting the operations of venues that have slot machines in terms of local infrastructure, extra police, et cetera, or to economic development.
But isn't that a kind of eyewash? I mean, the money's fungible in a sense. Once it's in the state system, you know, you can cut taxes, you can spend less elsewhere. Money flows.
These dollars are devoted specifically in the legislation and in a companion piece of legislation to relieving the increasing property tax burdens that Pennsylvanians have felt for the past 30 years. By this legislation and through the additional investments in education that we have made in Pennsylvania in the last 2 years, we are taking our state share of the education spend from about 35% to 44%. That's a huge increase. And these dollars are dedicated to that. We will not use them, and they cannot be used for general fund operations.
And what about the net loss that Bill Thompson points to when he looks at what slots mean for a particular community? Anyone you want to point to, Philadelphia, you name it.
Well, I don't agree with Professor Thompson's fundamental assumptions that he makes with respect to the dollars that are played in Philadelphia slot parlors. I think the point you made is the right one. People will come from outside of the city. Downtown Philadelphia is already a destination location for people. They will draw folks from New Jersey who now go to Atlantic City or to Delaware Park in Delaware. So I'm not sure that the math is as easily done as Professor Thompson suggests.
Bill Thompson, jump in here with us. You've got Governor Rendell's chief of staff. What do you say?
No, I'd love to jump in. Let me point out two jurisdictions that use the same philosophy. Bring the money home. Detroiters were going to Windsor, Ontario, to gamble. So the voters in Michigan were persuaded. Michigan was losing money to Windsor. We got to have Detroit casinos. Detroit now has three casinos. What did Windsor do? Did it shrivel up? No, it doubled its casinos. We have Niagara Falls, New York, now faced with New York casinos in Buffalo and Niagara Falls, New York, because New Yorkers were saying the money was going to Canada. What did Niagara Falls, Ontario do? Did they shrivel up? No, they've built a second casino. This means there is going to be more and more and more gambling. And I'll tell you what, it does make a difference. If you put a casino within 2 or 3 miles of someone's house, or there is another casino 75 miles away, it makes a big difference on what they do in their noon hour, what they do before work, after work, what they do for their recreation. By putting the casinos right in the middle of the cities where people live, many more people in Philadelphia will gamble. And let me give you another dynamic. Pennsylvania feels there's a big sucking machine in Atlantic City taking their money away. Atlantic City, like Las Vegas, manufactures nothing. So the money that goes to Atlantic City or comes to Las Vegas has to be spent. And when we purchase retail and wholesale goods in Las Vegas, we go to California. In Atlantic City, they go to Philadelphia.
Okay.
There is a symbiotic relationship, not a parasitical relationship. And besides that, the amount of money being gambled in Delaware and West Virginia pales in significance to the kind of money Pennsylvania is talking about. If they brought it all home, it wouldn't add up to what the 61,000 slot machines will get.
John Estey, how about that? Are you really delighted to see Philadelphians and Pennsylvanians around the state, or as the Wall Street Journal now calls you, Pennsylvegas? The Quakers must be quaking in their old boots. Are you really happy to see that many more people jumping into gambling? Are you worried about the social cost here?
No, clearly there is a social impact on gaming, and there's an attempt in this legislation to address that through supporting funds for Gamblers Anonymous and other programs to help people with compulsive gambling problems. But you know, you have to realize that Pennsylvanians have, in poll after poll, told their elected officials, including the governor, that they support legalized gaming in this commonwealth. Both the candidate, the Republican candidate for governor, was for legalized gaming, and the Democratic candidate for governor, who was elected, Governor Rendell, was for legalized gaming. The people here, in poll after poll, 70% of them say they are for it. They go to Atlantic City. They go to Delaware Park. They go to West Virginia. They want to be able to stay home, and they want their tax dollars, they want the dollars that are used from gambling, to be used to support property tax relief in their communities to bring down the increasing value that they have to pay for property taxes.
Richard McGowan, what do you make of this then? You can hear the arguments on both sides. Bottom line, is this a real net plus for a state like Pennsylvania, or a kind of cheap trick, or how do you describe it?
Well, I mean, I think Pennsylvania is probably trying to reclaim some of its revenue. Now, whether or not how successful it's going to be, I mean, by the way, I'm originally from Philadelphia, so I mean, for instance, they're going to build a new in Chester, PA. Chester is an incredibly depressed area right now, and
good place for gambling.
Well, it's an interesting point, Bill. I mean,
yes,
I mean,
yeah.
but you know, let's face it. You're also trying to make Atlantic City and Las Vegas not look like they're parasites, which I cannot believe you said that, Bill. I mean, they are the biggest parasites in the country.
We have a trade deficit with California. We buy more in California than sell services to Californians.
You're telling me that there aren't more Californians who spend money in Las Vegas, and then you buy services. I cannot believe that.
We buy products. Because what we do is we take money from the whole world. And in a sense, we're a parasite on the world. But it's a trading relationship. Only 20% of our players come from California.
Only 20%?
20%.
But Bill Thompson, just to put this on the table, you here tonight as a kind of defender of the Las Vegas industry? Are you trying to damp elsewhere?
Let me defend the manner of gambling on the Las Vegas Strip. It's a destination venture. People come to Las Vegas for 4 days. They spend more money non-gambling than gambling, and then they leave, and our economy grows.
I get it, but I just want to understand your interests. Are you defending Las Vegas against encroachment?
Am I working for the Las Vegas
casinos?
Yeah. The answer is Las Vegas will sell the slot machines. We will make a lot of money. And if gambling spreads around the United States, it has. Las Vegas has grown immeasurably since gambling spread around the United States. The spread of gambling helps Las Vegas. It doesn't hurt it. So if I'm speaking for Las Vegas, I should speak in favor of the gambling in Pennsylvania. We're going to sell the machines, and gambling is going to spread further, and Vegas will get benefits.
Bill Thompson, stand by. While we've got John Estey, I want to pick up a call or two from Pennsylvania, his home state. John Estey is the chief of staff for Pennsylvania Governor Ed Reddell. Al is calling right now from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Al. You're on the air. Hello, my friend Al. Are you there?
Erie.
Hello, Al.
Yes.
You're on the air, my friend.
Yes. I think you've made some very good points. Your experts there have made some very good points, but you've missed one. And that is, I think gambling of any kind, and I say this in Pennsylvania with regard to the state lottery, which has been in existence for a long time, and the new legislation on slot machines, is sending the wrong message. It's sending a message that people can get something for nothing.
And how do you add that into a state's calculation on whether or not it's the bottom line works or not, Al?
I think it just is the wrong message and is the wrong thing for a state government to be doing, to be promoting gambling of any kind.
John Estey, how about it? Are you making a few billion dollars and undercutting the very moral fiber of your citizenry?
Well, I think the answer to that is there was a very robust series of debates in Harrisburg, in the state capitol, on three separate days over the last 18 months over the wisdom of moving forward with legalized gaming. And those arguments were put in front of the various legislators, and they were asked to do the job that they were sent here for, which was represent their constituents. Certainly no one voted on any of these bills in a vacuum, and I think the result that we got 2 weeks ago reflected the will of the people of the Commonwealth. Again, the polls show over and over that the people want legalized gaming in this Commonwealth if the dollars are devoted to reducing their property taxes.
So we know what the vote was, and we know where you intend it to go. But at the same time, what about just simply the moral issue? Pennsylvania's got a long history and tied up with a moral understanding of the world and of life, and here you've got a constituent raising it, quite apart from the vote, just looking at it on moral terms. Do you see a problem with its impact on the morality, the psychology of Pennsylvanians?
I do not, and I do not because I think gaming has become a part of the social fiber of the United States of America and of the world, in fact. I think, like First Amendment rights, if people don't want to gamble, they don't have to gamble. And if they have problems with what it is that is presented to them, it is the state's obligation and provided for in this legislation that we provide support for those people who have difficulty dealing with the temptations that might be presented here. But I don't see this as a moral issue. I see this as an economic issue. We lose billions of dollars every year from Pennsylvanians who leave this Commonwealth to gamble in other places, and we need to keep those dollars at home.
Bill, or Richard McGowan, excuse me, what about this issue? There's a moral side, and as John Estey is acknowledging, there's a problem here with gambling addiction. We're looking at one study here that says casinos, for example, rely for a quarter to half of their revenues on compulsive gamblers, people who, in that same study, also tend to borrow money and not pay it back, commit credit card fraud, insurance fraud, kite checks, go bankrupt. The estimate here is that the problem gamblers cost the U.S. economy about $80 billion a year. When you bring that in, Richard McGowan, does it still add up for a state, for the country?
That's the problem. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, the argument there is the ends justify the means. And are the means... I mean, I'm not a prohibitionist, and I can see, you know, where, but there are a lot of people who really get hurt by gambling. For instance, right now in the New Jersey legislature, again, the ends justify the means argument here is New Jersey, to get an advantage over the other states, right now they had casinos, they are talking about legalizing sports gambling in New Jersey casinos. Well, you have really upped the ante. Excuse the gambling pun there. But, I mean, that would really... I can tell you, I've lived in a college dorm for 20 years.
And you're talking then about being able to go to New Jersey and bet on professional sports games across the country.
And college sports, right. And so you've really, I mean, my God, did they really realize how the college student now, how that would affect the college age students. There you really have, and I think the legislature has to really think about what they're doing there.
And Bill Thompson, what about the issue on the moral front of who bears the burden of gambling? Who's paying in here?
This is a tax, and we have to look at what's the tax incidence. Who does it fall on? And you find with standalone slot machines, they're played by poorer people. They're not the affluent people that fly to Vegas or go to Atlantic City in most cases. They're the people that ride the buses in on the tours, and they just are grind gamblers, and they tend to be poorer people and older people. And it's ironic that the older person lobby in Pennsylvania, the one that really pushes property tax relief
yeah,
is behind this, and it'll be a lot of older people that will be gambling and losing the money. And a compulsive gambler costs society, and I've done many studies, and it's approximately $10,000 a year in bad debts, thefts, and lost work. And the National Gambling Study Commission said if you put casino gambling in a community, the compulsive gambling rate will double. And it's not a big rate. It's right now 1%. It'll go to 2%. But if you have 5 million people, 2% or an extra 1% is an extra 50,000 compulsive gamblers.
John Esty, what about the issue of the regressive character of gambling revenues? Does it keep you up at night? Falling on the backs of the poor, let's say.
It does not, because I think, again, when you look at the way in which these particular venues will be put together and the way in which this commission will govern where they are, how they are constructed, how they are integrated into the community, I do believe that they will be part of, in the large urban centers, they will be part of a destination location for people to come to the city to stay overnight, to spend some time in a casino, but to spend time doing other things in downtown Philadelphia and in downtown Pittsburgh.
So you're just denying Bill Thompson on this front. He says it's going to be Philadelphians, for example, who primarily support slots in Philadelphia.
That may in fact be the case, but I don't think it will be solely Philadelphians. I think that there will be a draw of people from, as I said, South Jersey, from southeastern Pennsylvania. I know what Governor Rendell did when he was mayor of the city of Philadelphia to revitalize the center of that city, to bring people in overnight without any casinos. And I can tell you that if that is a model that we will use, and it is, that we will be bringing people to our convention center, which we hope to expand from all over South Jersey, southeastern Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia to spend their time there, not only sitting in front of sitting in a casino, but also using some of the other amenities that the city provides.
John Esty, we know the fix is in, and we wish you luck with it. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
John Esty, Chief of Staff for Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. We're talking tonight about the gaming fix, about cash-strapped states across the country turning to big-time gambling to balance budgets. I'm also joined by Bill Thompson and Richard McGowan. You can join this conversation. Does gambling ultimately pay? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the gaming fix, about states across the country turning to big-time gambling to balance their budgets. You can join our conversation tonight. When states balance budgets with gambling receipts, who's really paying? Is this a backdoor tax on the poor and middle class? If everybody's reaching for gambling, can any state afford not to? And is gambling ultimately good for American budgets, for American souls? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Richard McGowan, author of Dividing the Spoils, forthcoming book, professor of economics at Boston College, by Bill Thompson, who is professor of public administration at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, author of Gambling in America and Encyclopedia, and right now from Sacramento, California, by Jacob Coyne. He's executive director of the California Indian Nations Gaming Association. Jacob Coyne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Arnold Schwarzenegger is looking to pull more revenues out of Indian gaming in California and into the state of California budget. Is this a good thing, in your view?
Well, he's obviously made an important first step towards that end. On the other hand, the whole discussion about Indian gaming in this case really comes from a totally different viewpoint, and I've had the pleasure of listening to your other guests. I should say that at the outset that the whole premise of Indian gaming was really to enable tribes to generate revenues to strengthen their tribal governments, to be able to build economies and then provide for the general welfare of its members. And it's been successful to a large extent on those counts. I mean, if we were to judge the success or failure of Indian gaming, we should do so on the scorecard of what the Congress said ought to be the way to measure the success. But there's nothing in that federal law, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act passed in 1988, that says that these tribal gaming revenues are supposed to bail out states out of deficit situations.
But you know that a lot of states have the knife and fork out now. They look at Connecticut, where they get, a quarter of the revenue from the 6,400 slot machine at Foxwoods, and many other state governments are thinking, we'd like a piece of that.
Yeah, and that tends to be the case, the trend, rather, nowadays. And I think the Congress, in their wisdom, also anticipated that there ought to be some deference given to a state and the tribes within that state to fashion these agreements, you know, considering the unique circumstances that may be party to that relationship.
So right now you've got five of California's 64 tribes, as I understand, that have signed deals with the state. Are the rest of the tribes going to get on board here, or is this going to be a minority pitching in?
I think at the present time, at least, it's going to be a minority of the group of tribes making that move. But again, there are actually 107 federally recognized tribes. Of that number, 64 of them have actual compacts in hand. So there's quite a universe to draw from here in California.
I want to turn to more of our callers. Nancy's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Just great.
I've been fighting expanded gambling in the Commonwealth of Kentucky for over 10 years fairly successfully. But my concern and question to the economists is, if we have a saturation of gambling everywhere, and if it begins to take this much money out of the economy, I don't see that we've got that much discretionary money. Is it not finally going to erode the whole economy, which is based on the production of things?
And not just of hours at the slot machine.
Transfer of money, right, exactly.
Bill Thompson, what do you say to that?
Well, it's a negative because of the time invested. As long as the time is not recreation, people need recreation time so they can work harder and produce more things. So if gambling's just recreation time, it doesn't have that effect. But when it goes beyond recreation, a term Paul Samuelson, the economist, used in his book, when it goes beyond beyond recreation, it definitely hurts the economy. And the time you put into gambling and the energy the industry puts into it does not produce a product that adds value to society.
So how serious is that, Nancy, saying if we get it coast to coast, every state, every major city, where do you end up here for the economy overall?
If it's just recreation, it's just like having softball in every community, which we have.
But you know yourself, you've said yourself, it's more than that.
It's more than that. And the people close to the slot machines, when it's just a slot machine, I don't see the recreational value. I do see a recreational value in Tunica, in Atlantic City, and, of course, in Las Vegas, when people take vacations and they go to shows and they take in many events.
Richard McGowan, what do you say here?
I mean, I just don't see the difference whatsoever. I mean, to me, Bill, if somebody's gambling, they're gambling, and it's a form of entertainment.
Slot machine's the same whether it's
Why not? I mean, you're putting your value on what entertainment is, and
I mean,
it's a form of entertainment, and whether they're doing it in Chester, PA, or whether they're doing it in Las Vegas,
rather than getting held up on whether or not it's recreation, let's go to Nancy's question, Richard McGowan, the impact ultimately on the economy.
I mean, I think the ultimate thing on the economy, really, what I would be much more concerned about is how states are getting addicted to this revenue. And in certain senses, when they get addicted to this revenue, when they see that it's going to dry up from another state's competing for it, they up the ante.
And on it goes.
And so one of my concerns is, where do you stop? Where do you stop up the ante? I mean, now looks like New Jersey is going to go up all the way. And again, they're going to justify it by saying all our casino revenue goes to help the elderly in New Jersey. We don't want the elderly not to be – well, again, obviously, ironically, you're going to be hurting the elderly in the neighboring states to be doing that.
And yet, on the other hand, let me put this to each of you. Nancy's fought it hard in Lexington, Kentucky.
Sure.
But clearly, in other states and venues around the country, there's an appeal here, too. I mean, Pennsylvania just voted for it. You've got a lot of people who want gambling, either because they see it as a revenue earner or they just want it nearby to go and do it. How do you respond to that, Bill?
There's an illusion that there's a public demand for this, and public opinion polls are one thing, but the money behind it is the casino industry, the slot machine industry, and an industry that pushes campaign contributions to politicians, and politicians that see the magic, we can have taxes without raising taxes, illusion. It's not a public demand. The public has access to gambling already. If they want gambling, they have the freedom already to drive to Atlantic City or within an hour or two of their home, find a casino. The freedom's already there. This is excess.
Richard McGowan, we've just got a minute left here. Where do you think this is all headed? Are we going to see the United States blanketed in gambling venues?
I don't see how you're going to avoid it, to be quite honest, strictly because, for instance, if you looked at the spread of lotteries from 1964 on, I mean, as the states legalized it, the neighboring state felt the pressure to do it. And the same thing is happening with casino. I mean, because one of the things the legislators don't want to have to do is raise taxes. I mean, again, I guess in certain ways it's an ancient tradition. Jefferson called a lottery the best tax that we could put on people. It's a voluntary tax. Now, I think that the real question is it voluntary? Mm-hmm. Is it really voluntary? And, I mean, and that's the interesting thing because, I mean, if somebody's – now, the addiction rate's not that high.
It's not voluntary.
It's not that voluntary. And then the other thing that does hit me is that the states, they should be much more trying to make gambling fair.
Meaning?
Oh, the games are outrageously against the
– the odds are rigged against the players.
Against the players. And I think it's outrageous, that, you know, the way that they've allowed the casino industry to rig it against
the players.
But,
of course, when states get into it, the more it's rigged, the more revenue there is, and they have an interest in keeping it that way. We're out of time. What a topic. Very interesting. And off it goes. Richard McGowan with me in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And Bill Thompson with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, author of Gambling in America. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Stephen Hawking loses a high-profile scientific bet. This is On Point. Renowned British astrophysicist Stephen Hawking today conceded that his famous 1975 theory on black holes was wrong, losing one of the most famous bets in the history of science. The author of A Brief History of Time had originally said that black holes destroy all matter they suck up. American physicist John Preskill of Caltech challenged that theory in 1997, leading to the bet that Hawking today acknowledged he had lost. As a prize, Hawking offered a baseball book to his victorious colleague. In accepting defeat, the famous wheelchair-bound scientist, who speaks through a speech synthesizer, said his change of opinion is a boon to science, not to science fiction.
This result implies that everything in the universe is determined by the laws of science.
I'm joined now by Robert Noya, senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. Bob Noya, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to be on your program.
So here we had such an exciting theory from Stephen Hawking that black holes sucked up everything that they consumed, and science fiction people, and maybe Hawking himself, speculating off of that, that people might one day use black holes to travel to other universes. Has that door closed today?
In terms of what most scientists think, that door has been closed for a very long time. This might be kind of a final nail in the coffin of that idea, although I would speculate that some scientists and certainly science fiction writers will you know, continue to use this idea of using black holes or wormholes to travel from one universe to another.
We've got to define some terms here for us lay folk. Black holes and wormholes, same thing or different?
Black holes are objects that form, for example, at the end of a life of a star when it collapses, where a large amount of mass is scrunched by gravity into a very tiny volume of space, so that gravity becomes so strong that not even light can escape from inside a black hole. We know that black holes exist. Astronomers have found them both in our galaxy and other galaxies. Wormholes are purely speculative or hypothetical. Those are thought to be kind of bridges or tunnels that might link one point in our universe to a distant point in our universe, or possibly even connect parallel universes. At the moment, there is no observational evidence whatsoever that wormholes actually exist.
And today was all about black holes. Stephen Hawking is 62 now. He made a big splash in the 70s, sold 10 million copies of A Brief History of Time. And he was proposing there that no matter came back out of a black hole, and it had to go somewhere, so maybe it went to a parallel universe. What did he say today?
It's a little more subtle, actually. He actually first became famous in the scientific community in the early 1970s by arguing that matter could, in fact, escape black holes, but he argued that the matter coming out of a black hole would carry no information with it about the matter that originally formed the black hole. And what he was saying today is actually that the information can, in fact, get back out of the black hole. In other words, a black hole sort of preserves a memory of the material that formed the black hole in the first place. And that's the bet that he conceded today to a physicist, John Preskill, of the California Institute of Technology.
Now, Preskill was challenging Hawking on the basis of subatomic theory that said that matter can never be completely destroyed, I guess including the information of matter.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the real key point here, everyone agreed from Hawking's papers back in the early 70s that material can eventually escape out of black holes. The big point of disagreement, though, was whether that matter coming out of a black hole, which is named Hawking radiation in Stephen Hawking's honor, whether that matter would actually preserve the information about the material that fell into the black hole in the first place. And most physicists actually would have agreed with Preskill, and so Hawking and a few others are kind of the last holdouts, and it was certainly interesting to see today that Hawking finally came around and accepted what many other scientists have long expected.
Hawking was presenting today in Dublin at the International Conference on General Relativity and Gravitation. He said, "There is no baby universe branching off as I once thought," speaking to about 800 physicists and scientists. He said, "I'm sorry to disappoint science fiction fans, but if information is preserved, there is no possibility of using black holes to travel to other universes. If you jump into a black hole, your mass energy will be returned to our universe." It sounds as though, for most scientists, this was a long overdue concession.
I would think so, yeah. I mean, certainly among science fiction writers, it's been popular to imagine traveling between different universes. It should be emphasized there's no absolute proof or observational evidence right now that other universes even do in fact exist.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would say a lot of physicists, and I would say myself as a science journalist included, believe it's quite possible, if not inevitable, that there are other universes. But certainly any ideas about traveling between universes, you know, from one universe to another, at this moment remains very speculative and hypothetical. And for example, these other universes, if they do in fact exist, might have physical laws that are completely different from our universe, where stars can't form or planets or life cannot even exist.
I'm sorry to disappoint science fiction fans, Stephen Hawking saying today. Robert Noya, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me, Tom.
Robert Noya, senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.